Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prastai Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vinanda Swamini Karamane Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pacharane Nivase Shasangavari Pashkatade Zatarane Om Ganatamirandasya Jana Jana Sulakaya Taksus Militan Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namah Sri Chaitanya Manavistam Stavitam Devutale Sayam Rupakadamayam Dadati Sa Pandantikam Vanjagopadu Vyascha Kripasindu Vai Vasha Vitanam Bhagane Vyo Vaishnavi Vyo Namo Nama. Was Chaitanya out there?
She's there. She's
Jad Bharat had been captured by Maharaj Rahugana, who was heading towards Kapila Ashram, and he needed another palanquin carrier. So they enlisted Jad Bharat. But Jad Bharat was not very efficient in carrying it because he was concerned that he would not step on any ants. And as a result of that, he could not be synchronized with the other palanquin carriers. And the result was a very bumpy ride for the king. And the king became very upset. First, when he was disturbed by the palanquin carrying, first he responded with sarcastic words. And then, when it didn't solve the problem, he became angry and yelled at Jad Bharat. And Jad Bharat, out of his causeless mercy at that time, decided to instruct the king. Now, we saw that previously Jad Bharat was chastised and neglected and put in so many difficult situations by his brothers. He did not respond in any way. He kept up the act that he was dull, retarded. Even though inside he was fully awake on the spiritual level. But externally, to avoid social interaction, he remained as if he was a madman or retarded. But in any case, he didn't respond when his brothers treated him improperly. And then when the thieves and captured him and wanted to sacrifice him to the Vajrakali deity, he didn't respond, he didn't protect himself. But yet, when Maharaj Rahugana chastised him just with his words, he decided to speak. Now why? Why didn't he speak the other times? And why did he speak at this time? This is the free will of a devotee, that he decides to show his mercy where he wants to show that mercy. Or one can say there is some being impelled by Krishna, because the devotee is the carrier of Krishna's Kripa Shakti. Because we see in the spiritual world, what is Krishna doing? He's in Vrindavan playing with the cowherd boys. He's playing with the gopis. He's playing with his parents, Mother Yasoda and Nanda Maharaj. And his mind, even though he is God, even though he knows everything in one sense, but his mind is not on the material world and the fallen, suffering, conditioned souls. And this could be quite disconcerting in one sense. There he is in the spiritual world just enjoying, and here we are, and he's the supreme controller. Here we are suffering, our hearts are breaking, we're dying, there's wars, and he's just dancing. So is this a compassionate God? But actually, Krishna does show compassion in the material world personally by his Kripa Shakti. He does so many things with his energies. He doesn't do everything personally. Like the king or the president, there may be some need for some intervention in some neighborhood somewhere. So it's not that he personally has to go every time, no. He just sends one of his agents, which means basically his energy, someone, some potency of his to rectify the situation. But it's the king's power that is working through that person, because when that person comes and says, stop doing this, change it to like this, do it like everyone does it. Why? Because the energy of the government, personified by the energy of the king, is behind him. So similarly, Krishna does show mercy in this world directly, but he does it in a very wonderful way, and that is through his devotees. And the devotees are those who carry the Lord's energy, the internal energy of the Lord. Therefore, Krishna Shakti Nahivina Tapavatana. So Krishna, when there's preaching being done, in one sense we say that oh look, the devotees are preaching. Or we say, oh, how you made this person a devotee and this person made, but actually what's happening is Krishna is doing it. Or another way to looking at it is that our Guru Maharaj is doing it, and we are just assisting. But ultimately it's Krishna who's doing it through his energies, and the desire of a devotee is to assist Krishna, to be instrumental for Krishna to fulfill the desires of Krishna. So what the devotee does, he harmonizes his desires with his desires. Usually in the material world, even pious people, what do they want, they desire something and they turn to God and pray. So they want God to harmonize his desires with their own desires, which of course is ridiculous. Because who knows best, me or he? So he knows best, so we are meant dva ima purushaloke chara akshare vacha chara savabhutani kutosto. We are meant to become one with him in the sense of our desires, our independentness, our selfish, petty, very small desires, which take into account only how reality is from our perspective, which is obviously very limited. So we're meant to harmonize our desires with his desires. Give up our small world perspective on reality. So Jad Bharat, by his will, by Krishna's will, he decided to show mercy to the king, Rahugana Maharaj. And it flowed from him, and it flowed from him as he began to say, the things that you have said about me, in your sarcastic words, they're true, because I am neither stout, nor thin, nor maybe my body is fatigued, but that has nothing to do with me. I'm a soul, I'm eternal. He spoke from a very high spiritual, non-material level of realization. Because usually, in our conventional way of speaking, how are you today? Oh, I'm fine. What are we talking about? We're just talking about body and mind. But Jad Bharat completely neglected those levels and began speaking on a completely different level, on an eternal level. So the king, we've read how Jadbarat, after talking to the king, he basically picked up the chariot and started acting as the chariot, as the palanquin carrier again. But the king understood that this was no ordinary person. And now we're going to hear what he said. Sukadeva Goswami is narrating this to Maharaj Prakrit. O best of the Pandu dynasty, Maharaj Prakrit, the king of Sindhu and Sovir states, that's Maharaj Rugana, excuse me, the Sindhu and Sovir states, had great faith in the discussions of the Absolute Truth. So he had a taste. He was no fool himself. He knew transcendental words when he heard them. So being thus qualified, he heard from Jadbarat that philosophical presentation was which is approved by all scriptures on the mystic yogic process, meaning on the transcendent reality, and which slackens the knot in the heart. Why is it called the knot in the heart? That's K-N-O-T. Not saying that it's not in the heart, but there is something in the heart that is in the heart, and that's a knot. And that knot is called ahankar. The linkage of the soul, which has nothing to do, in fact, with the material body, with that material body. There's a knot of illusion. And that illusion is called false ego, or ahankar. So this type of philosophical discussions, it loosens the knot in the heart. It slackens it. The identification with the body changes. His material conception of himself as a king was thus destroyed. He immediately descended from his palanquin and fell flat on the ground with his head at the lotus feet of Jadbarat in such a way that he might be excused for his insulting words against the great Brahmana. He then prayed as follows. So we'll hear of the words that he spoke. And this is actually the glory of the Vedic culture, because everyone, but especially learned persons, understood that the purpose of life was to conquer birth and death, that the purpose of life was to awaken the soul's consciousness. So he recognized that the king recognized that the words of Jadbarat were true and they had potency. He recognized Jadbarat was a realized soul, that he was advanced, didn't identify with his body. We talk about that, identifying with the body. I'm not my body, you're not your body. But Jadbarat, in his consciousness, did not identify with the body. When he thought of who he was, he didn't think of a body. He thought of something eternal, that consciousness. Servant of Krishna. Consciousness is the symptom of the soul. So here's the first thing that the king said. O Brahman, you appear to be moving in this world very much covered and unknown to others. Who are you? Are you a learned Brahmana and saintly person? I see that you are wearing a sacred thread. Are you one of those exalted liberated saints such as Dattatreya and other highly advanced learned scholars? Because Dattatreya was very famous for being an avaduta. He was an impersonalist, though. And he's described in the 11th canto, when the Maharaj Yadu meets Dattatreya, who is acting like a python. How does a python act? How does he get his food? He just opens his mouth and sees what Krishna sends and accepts that. So Dattatreya was fully satisfied. And Maharaj Yaru met him and he was amazed. You're not working at all to become happy or to become healthy or to become fat. And yet I see that you're happy and healthy and satisfied. And I see that everyone else is running around like mad trying to attain these things and no one's getting them. But you're not doing anything and you're so satisfied. What is the cause of this? And then he spoke. He explained. He said, where did you learn this? And he told him, oh, I have had many gurus. And then he explained his gurus to him. And so this is in the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam. Very, very interesting. So are you Dattatreya or other highly advanced liberated souls, learned scholars? May I ask, whose disciple are you? Where do you live? Why have you come to this place? Is your mission in coming here to do good for us? Please let me know who you are. So Yadbharat will answer these questions. We're in chapter 10 right now. He'll answer these questions in chapter 12. So at the end of the chapter, answer these particular questions about his history, who he is, why he's there. Text 17. My dear sir, I am not at all afraid of the thunderbolt of King Indra. Now, have you ever been close to a thunderbolt or a very heavy lightning, and when thunder is rolling? Very, very frightening, actually. But he's not afraid of that, he says. Nor am I afraid of the serpentine piercing trident of Lord Shiva. I do not care about the punishment of Yamaraj, the superintendent of death. Nor am I afraid of fire, which burns and causes so much pain. Scorching sun, I do not fear the moon, wind, nor the weapons of Kuvera. Yet, I am afraid of offending a Brahmana. I am very much afraid of this. So therefore, he was on his hands outraged, on his belly, begging, touching the lotus feet of Yadbharat, asking him, begging him to forgive. Here's Prabhupada's purport. When Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was instructing Rupa Goswami at the Dasyatmeda Ghat in Prayag, he pointed out very clearly the seriousness of offending a Vaishnava. He compared the Vaishnava aparad, to Hatimata, a mad elephant. When a mad elephant enters a garden, it spoils all the roots and flowers, it uproots, tramples everything. Similarly, if one offends a Vaishnava, he spoils all his spiritual assets. Offending a Brahmana is very dangerous, and this was known to Maharaj Rahugana. He therefore frankly admitted his fault. There are many dangerous things, thunderbolts, fire, Yamaraj's punishment, the punishment of Lord Shiva's trident, and so forth. But none is considered as serious as offending a Brahmana like Yadbharat. Why? Why is it worse to offend a Vaishnava than get pierced with a trident or struck with a thunderbolt?
These things can only hurt you materially,
but not spiritually. Yeah. You stop on the bodily level. If you get hit with a thunderbolt, maybe you had done something to someone before, and boom, your life has ended, and that reaction is finished, and you go on. But if one offends a Vaishnava, then the reaction will inhibit one's going back home, back to Godhead, for a very long time. So therefore, Maharaj Rahugana immediately descended from his palanquin. And that's why Prabhupada established very early in the early days of the movement. I don't remember when, maybe 74 the latest. He established that each morning the devotees, they offer their obeisances to each other. It's to each other. Please forgive me in our working together. There's often familiarity, which breeds contempt. We see each other every day. We see the faults, everyone's faults. So please forgive me if I've done something to disturb you or offend you. And in the very early days of the movement, even in the 60s, when the devotees, and the 70s, when the devotees would, they'd get, everyone would was living all together, and then they'd get up in the morning, and then when the first time you saw every person, you'd offer obeisances to them. Was that what you're doing? It changes things. So, Jad Bharat immediately descended from his palanquin and fell flat before the lotus feet of the Brahmana Jad Bharat. Excuse me, Maharaj Rahugana. Fell flat before the lotus feet of the Brahmana Jad Bharat, just to be excused. He continues. He said, I'm not afraid of so many things, but this I'm afraid of. My dear sir, it appears that the influence of your great spiritual knowledge is hidden. Factually, you are bereft of all material association and fully absorbed in the thought of the Supreme. Consequently, you are unlimitedly advanced in spiritual knowledge. Please tell me why you are wandering around like a dullard. O great saintly person, you have spoken words approved by the yogic process, but it is not possible for us to understand what you have said. Therefore, kindly explain it. We'll read a little of the purport. Sometimes, Prabhupada explains, it is very risky to give great philosophical instructions to ordinary people. But Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, for the benefit of the fallen souls of Kali Yuga, has given us a very nice instrument, the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. The general mass of people, although sudras and less, can be purified by chanting this Hare Krishna mantra. Then they can understand the exalted philosophical statements of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. Our Krishna consciousness movement has therefore adopted the chanting of the Hare Krishna Mahamantra for the general masses. When people gradually become purified, they are instructed in the lessons of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. So Maharaj Rahugana continues saying, he's saying, I can't quite understand what you have said. You have explained many things, but I don't quite understand them. I consider your good self, and here's his first philosophical question. He asked, why are you here? Where do you come from? What's your history? You're wandering around. Please tell me. But now he's going to ask a philosophical question. Now, after I read this verse, I'm going to ask what that question was. I consider your good self the most exalted master of mystic power. He's apologized to him. Please forgive me. You're so powerful. You know the spiritual science perfectly well. You're the most exalted of all learned sages, and you have descended for the benefit of human society. You have come to give spiritual knowledge, and you are the direct representative of Kapiladev, the incarnation of God and plenary portion of knowledge. I am therefore asking you, O spiritual master, what is the most secure shelter in this world? So he's taking shelter of him. What's his question?
What's the most secure shelter?
Yeah, what is the most secure shelter in this world? So remember that the king was on his way to Kapila Ashram. His desire was to gain the mercy of Kapiladev. So he saw this Jad Bharat as the representative of Kapiladev, because Kapiladev gave the Sankhya Yoga, which discriminates between the soul and the body, which teaches the living entity to separate the soul's existence with the 20 some odd material elements. Sankhya means counting. So to count the material elements and see that the soul is not one of them. So he saw that Bharat is none different from Kapila Muni, and he wished, therefore, to take shelter of Jadbharat. And he accepted him as none different from Kapila Muni in the same way that we accept spiritual master as none different from the Lord. Shakshad Hari. So he's asked, what is the most secure shelter in this world? Now he's going to ask another question. How can I advance in spiritual life? Is it not a fact that your good self is the direct representative of Kapiladev, the incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead? To examine people and see who is actually a human being and who is not, you have presented yourself to be a deaf and dumb person. Are you not moving this way upon the surface of the world? I am very attached to family life and worldly activities, and I am blind to spiritual knowledge. Nonetheless, I am now present before you, and I am seeking enlightenment from you. How can I advance in spiritual life? So what question is that? How can I advance? Here is some of Prabhupada's purport. Although Maharaj Rahugana was playing the part of a king, he had been informed by Jad Bharat that he was not a king, nor was Jad Bharat deaf and dumb. Such designations were simply coverings of the spirit soul. Everyone must come to this knowledge. We hear this again and again and again. And again and again and again. That we are not the bodies, that we are souls. We are eternal, we're souls. We're not our bodies, we're souls. And one day, maybe it will sink in. And we'll actually understand that the consciousness is a symptom of us. And we are not the dull body. Although we all know this, we've watched ourselves and others change their bodies and yet remain the same person. But yet, out of habit, we identify with the body. But one day, we'll understand that we are not the body. We are souls. We are eternal. We have nothing to fear from the death of the body, from the illness of the body. So Jad Bharat told him, you are not the king and I am not this. Now we're in that position, but in next life it may change. Such designations were simply coverings of the spirit soul. Everyone must come to this knowledge. As confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita, Dehinos Minyata Dehe. Everyone is encased within the body. Since the body is never identical with the soul, the bodily activities are simply illusory, temporary and false when we think that we are doing it. False in that sense. They are going on, not that it's illusion in the sense it's not really there, but it's not really there in the sense that it is not us who is hungry, who is tired, who is growing old. The soul never grows old. And it is also illusory in the sense that we tend to think our situation is eternal, and in fact it's temporary. So in the association of such a sadhu as Jad Bharat, Maharaj Rahugana came to the awareness that his activities as a royal authority was simply illusory phenomena. He therefore agreed to receive knowledge from Jad Bharat, and that was the beginning of his perfection. So this question of how can I advance, when the next chapter begins, he's going to give some tattva about this. Some of the spiritual truth that we tend not to be aware of about the binding of the soul. So knowing this will help Maharaj Rahugana advance, and it will also help us advance. So more or less the entire next chapter, chapter 11, when Jad Bharat begins to reply to the questions that Maharaj Rahugana asked, he's going to explain the cause of the bondage of the living entity. And then in chapter 12, in verses 12 and 13, he's going to describe the main factor, practically speaking, the main factor in the process of getting free from bondage. The main factor. So we have that to look forward to. So he's asked right now, how can I advance? Now more questions. You have said, I am not fatigued from labor. Although the soul is different from the body. Now listen to this. It's quite interesting. Because he's not just a blind hearer. He's or a deaf hearer. We hear and don't really accept, and it doesn't really, our mind is thinking about so many other things and we don't really hear what's been said. Rather, he's heard very carefully. But he has a frame of reference in which what he's heard has gone into. And it doesn't tally with his frame of reference, what he already understands about life. So therefore he questions to get to be able to clearly change his own way of thinking. So he says, you have said, I am not fatigued from labor. As Jad Bharat told him, you have said, you must be so tired. You've been carrying it for so long. Been sarcastic. But he said, no, I'm not tired. The body may be tired, but it doesn't have anything to do with me. So he said, so Maharaj Rahugana heard that, and he said, you have said that I am not fatigued from labor. Although the soul is different from the body, there is fatigue because of bodily labor. And it appears to be the fatigue of the soul. Doesn't it seem that way? We may not be our body, but if we're the soul, if we're the identity, when we feel hungry or tired, we feel it. When you're carrying the palanquin, there is certainly labor for the soul. It may be illusory, but he's laboring. This is my conjecture. You have also said that the external behavior exhibited between the master and the servant is not factual. And actually, from what I've seen in any looking through philosophy or different religions, there is always a very vague differentiation between the body and the soul, except in the Vedic science of Krishna consciousness, where it clearly says no, we're independent of the body completely. Our existence has nothing to do with the body. But most religions don't speak like that at all. I say that it's so tied up, and even if you die and then if you go to heaven, your body will go. Things like that. Because they cannot distinguish with clarity between the eternal soul and the temporary body. So he says, this is my conjecture. There is labor for the soul. You have also said that the external behavior exhibited between the master and the servant is not factual. But although in the phenomenal world it is not factual, the products of the phenomenal world can actually affect things. So if this is illusion, how come I'm affected by it? Because you can't become affected by an illusion. If I'm imagining that there is a money flying through the sky, can I grab that imaginary money and spend it? No. It's imaginary. It'll vaporize when I try to grab it. It's not there. So if this material world and the things of the material world are illusory, how can anyone affect anyone else? How can anything affect anyone else? So he's saying, that's not my experience. My experience is, things can actually affect other things in the material world. That is visible, and it is experienced. As such, even though material activities are impermanent, they cannot be said to be untrue. So Judd Barrett's going to answer this. Here is Prabhupada's purport. This is a discussion on impersonal Mayavad philosophy and the practical philosophy of Vaishnavas. The Mayavad philosophy explains this phenomenal world to be false, but Vaishnava philosophers do not agree. They know that the phenomenal world is a temporary manifestation, but it is not false. A dream that we see at night is certainly false, but a horrible dream certainly affects the person seeing it. The soul's fatigue is not factual, but as long as one is immersed in the illusory bodily conception, one is affected by such false dreams. When dreaming, it is not possible to avoid the actual facts, and the conditioned soul is forced to suffer due to his dream. A water pot is made of earth and is temporary. Actually, there is no water pot. There is simply earth. In what sense is there no water pot? Simply earth.
Because it's not
earth. Yeah, but it's temporary. In other words, in time, that water pot is, you see its water pot, and then in 3,000 years, what will you see if you look at it? You'll see just the earth. So looking ahead is a function of intelligence. So actually there is no water pot. Actually means what exists eternally is actual, factual. Actual means factual. Factual means true. True means eternal. If something is temporary, it's considered non-factual. And in that sense, non-existent. This is in the language of the Bhagavad Gita in the second chapter. So a water pot is made of earth and is temporary. Actually, there is no water pot, there is simply earth. However, as long as the water pot can contain water, we can use it in that way. It cannot be said to be absolutely false, completely illusory. King Ruhugana continued, more questions. So these are good questions. My dear sir, you have said that designations like bodily fatness and thinness are not characteristics of the soul. That is incorrect. So maybe there are fat souls and skinny souls, and intelligent souls and dumb souls, and let's see what he says. You have said that the designation like bodily fatness and thinness are not characteristics of the soul. That is incorrect, because designations like pain and pleasure are certainly felt by the soul. So if it has nothing to do with the soul, how can we be feeling these things? You may put a pot of milk and rice within fire, and the milk and rice are automatically heated one after another. Similarly, due to bodily pain and pleasures, the senses, mind, and soul are affected. If the consciousness is affected, then the soul is affected, because the consciousness is a symptom of the soul. The soul cannot be completely detached from this conditioning. This is what he's saying. Purport. This argument put forward by Maharaj Ruhugana is correct from the practical point of view, but it arises from an attachment to the bodily conception. Actually, Devahuti asked the same question to Kapila Muni. She said, when he described how the nature of the material world and how the soul had been entangled in the material world for so long, she asked, is it even possible actually to separate the soul from its material situation? And if you think about it, if we took away all our material conditioning, what do you think would be left? That's what she says. Would anything be left if you took all the matter away? And Prabhupada said that is voidistic. But it feels like that. So it's true from the practical point of view, but it arises from an attachment to the bodily conception. It can be said that a person sitting in his car is certainly different from his car. But if there is damage to the car, the owner of the car, being overly attached to the car, feels pain. So if there... Well, there must be a quiet way to do that. I know there is.
Yeah.
But it takes thinking about it before. Because the devotees are so attentive in their hearing, the silence is so great, the dropping of a small bead sounds as if a boulder has dropped from above, a huge mammoth boulder, due to the attentiveness of the devotee's consciousness focused on the Bhagavatam. Actually, the damage done to the car has nothing to do with the car's proprietor, but because the proprietor has identified himself with the interest of the car, he feels pleasure and pain connected with it. He invests himself, his consciousness, where he is not. This conditional state can be avoided if attachment is withdrawn from the car. That means, on the other side, it is withdrawn to something. So on one side, withdrawn from, and the other side, withdrawn to. So withdrawn from matter, the temporary, the illusoriness, that which we are not, and focused upon that which we are. So when that attachment is withdrawn from the car, then the proprietor would not feel pleasure or pain if the car is damaged or whatever. Similarly, the soul has nothing to do with the body and the senses, but due to ignorance, he identifies himself with the body, and he feels pleasure and pain due to bodily pleasure and pain. So Prabhupada's answering the question. He's saying yes and no. Ruhugana Maharaj's points are true from the practical point of view, from the experienced point of view, but from the eternal point of view, from the truth point of view, from the philosophical point of view, from the point of view of reality, it is not true. So which do we want to be separate, to be situated within? Reality or practical temporary illusory situation? That's really the question. My dear sir, the king continues, you have said that the relationship between the king, now this is very personal for him, because he said you're not actually the king in those subjects, but he's given his whole life to being the king, and when you're a king, you invest your whole false ego in that very, very deeply. I am the king, and you have to be in that mood. Otherwise you can't do your service, your work, like being a parent, or anything. You have to do it with your full intention. And John Maritis told him, no, you're not the king. My dear sir, you have said that the relationship between the king and the subject, or between the master and the servant, they are not eternal. But although such relationships are temporary, when a person takes the position of a king, his duty is to rule the citizens and punish those who are disobedient to the laws. By punishing them, he teaches the citizen to obey the laws of the state. Again, you have said that punishing a person who is deaf and dumb is like chewing the chewed or grinding the pulp. That is to say, there is no benefit in it. However, if one is engaged in his own occupational duty, as ordered by the Supreme Lord, his sinful activities are certainly diminished. So he's saying that if this is illusion, how could one be benefited by illusion? And these are the orders of the Lord to engage in these activities. So by doing it, I'm purified. So how could it be illusion? How could something illusory purify you? Therefore, if one is engaged in his occupational duty by force even, he benefits because he can vanquish all his sinful activities in that way. So I'm benefited by performing my duty as a king, and the people who I'm forcing to perform their duties, they're benefited. So how is this illusion? Here's Prabhupada's purport. Now Prabhupada brings this to a different level. This argument offered by Maharaj Rahugana is certainly very effective. And as Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Srila Rupa Goswami says, Tasmat kenapi upayena mana Krishna naveshayet. Somehow or other, one should engage in Krishna consciousness. Actually, every living being is an eternal servant of Krishna. But due to forgetfulness, the living entity engages himself as an eternal servant of Maya. As long as one is engaged in Maya's service, he cannot be happy. Our Krishna consciousness movement aims at engaging people in Lord Krishna's service. Now what's the difficulty? Is that people don't want to be engaged in Lord Krishna's service at all. That will help them become free from all material contamination and sinful activities. But they don't want to. This is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita, Vita Ragavaya Krodha. By becoming detached from material activities, we will be freed from fear and anger. By austerity, so no one wants to be detached from material activities. But that it's good for them, it will free them. Kama esha krodha esha rajaguna samudbhava. And by austerity, one becomes purified and eligible to receive. So no one wants to be detached. No one wants to perform austerity. No one wants to be forced. But yet it's good for them. What about that? And what is the relationship of that to the Krishna consciousness movement? The duty of the king is to rule his citizens in such a way that they can become Krishna conscious. This would be very beneficial for everyone. Unfortunately, the king or president engages people in sense gratification. Boulders come rolling towards the speaker of the Bhagavatam. Hurled by angry hearers who don't want to be forced. Prabhupada said this would be very beneficial for everyone. Unfortunately, the king or president engages people in sense gratification instead of the Lord's service. If that was what we were doing, then everyone would like us very much. And such activities are certainly not beneficial for anyone. King Rahugana tried to engage Jad Bharat in carrying the palanquin, which is a form of sense gratification for the king. However, if one is engaged as a palanquin carrier in the Lord's service, or a swing pusher, for the Lord's jhulan, that is certainly beneficial. In this godless civilization, if a president engages people somehow or another in devotional service or the awakening of Krishna consciousness, he renders the very best service to the citizens. So this was very much how Prabhupada looked at what he had to do. People didn't want Krishna consciousness. What did people want? To enjoy their senses. People wanted to do what was bad for them. And did not want to do what was good for them. So what does a person with knowledge do? The king maybe can force, but certainly the members of the Krishna consciousness movement can't force, and Prabhupada couldn't force. So somehow or another, that was in some senses Prabhupada's practical motto of how to proceed. Somehow or another to get the work done of helping people engaging them somehow or another in Krishna consciousness. And if someone does that, he renders the very best service to the citizens. Now he's concluding his words. So he says, "Whatever you have spoken appears to me contradictory, O best friend of the distressed. I've committed a great offense by insulting you. I was puffed up with false prestige due to possessing the body of a king. For this I've certainly become an offender. Therefore I pray that you kindly glance at me with your causeless mercy. If you do so, I can be relieved from sinful activities brought about by insulting you. Oh, my dear Lord, you are the friend of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the friend of all living entities. You are therefore equal to everyone, and you are free from the bodily conception. Although I have committed an offense by insulting you, I know there is no loss or gain for you due to my insult. You are fixed in your determination, but I have committed an offense because of this. Even though I may be as strong as Lord Shiva, I shall be vanquished without delay due to my offense at the lotus feet of a Vaishnava." So we'll read these last two purports. And that ends the chapter, chapter 10. Purport to 24. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has said that by offending a Vaishnava, one finishes all his spiritual activities. Offending a Vaishnava is considered the mad elephant offense. What is mad elephant? In the last purport that we read that described this, what was the Sanskrit terms of Bengali? Mati hati. Hati mati. Which is it? Hati mata. A mad elephant can destroy an entire garden which has been developed with great labor. One may attain the topmost platform of devotional service, but somehow or another, if he offends a Vaishnava, the whole structure collapses. Unconsciously, King Rahugana offended Judd Bharat, but due to his good sense, he asked to be excused. This is the process by which one can be relieved from a Vaishnava Bharat. Krishna is always very simple and by nature merciful. When one commits an offense at the feet of a Vaishnava, one must immediately apologize to such a personality so that his spiritual advancement may not be hampered. And then the last purport. Maharaj Rahugana was very intelligent and conscious of the inauspicious effects arising from insulting a Vaishnava. He was therefore very anxious to be excused by Jada Bharat. Following the footsteps of Maharaj Rahugana, everyone should be very cautious not to commit an offense at the lotus feet of a Vaishnava. Srila Vrindavan Das Thakur in Chaitanya Bhagavat says, and I'll just read the English, there's five verses here, "Even if one is as strong as Lord Shiva, who carries a trident in his hand, one will nonetheless fall down from his spiritual position if he tries to insult a Vaishnava. That is the verdict of all Vedic scriptures." He also says this in Chaitanya Bhagavat in a different place. "Vaishnavera ninda karivekar yarigan tara raksha samatya nahika kono jan." One who blasphemes a Vaishnava cannot be protected by anyone. Even if a person is as strong as Lord Shiva, if he blasphemes a Vaishnava, he is sure to be destroyed. This is the verdict of all Shastras. If one does not care for the verdict of the Shastras and dares blaspheme a Vaishnava, he suffers life after life because of this. So should we be careful? Yes. And we see, even Judd Bharat was quite innocent. He didn't know. How would he know? Excuse me, Maharaj Rahugana. How would he know that this person was an exalted soul? But yet, as soon as he came to his mind, as soon as he understood, immediately begged forgiveness. Intelligent. So he's brought up many, many interesting questions. And now we'll hear some answers starting next week. Thank you very much, Hare Krishna. Any questions or comments? You had, yes.
It sounds as though from this that he finishes all his spiritual activities and the whole structure collapses. It sounds like as if he loses everything.
Yes.
Even if he's really, really, very highly advanced.
Yes.
But is it that he loses everything? Because isn't it that whatever advancement one makes, that's like a permanent asset?
Yes.
So what actually...
He loses everything temporarily. Everything is temporarily put on hold. Never lost, but held up for a while until it's cleared somehow or another. But that while can be some time.
And he can suffer a lot during that while.
Yeah, if you have something and you lose it, you suffer. I have it in also in Bhakti Sundarbha Jiva Goswami describes the effects of Vaishnava Bharat that carry life after life, and they're then the ones that he describes aren't as much suffering like
born in a horrible family.
Not that kind of a thing, but you're not able to prosecute bhakti properly. Saying, but he's frankly saying, I can't understand. He said, I'm bewildered. No, he's saying, I can't understand. They seem appear contradictory to me. Not that they're contradictory, they appear contradictory to me. And when we approach a spiritual master and ask him questions, we should speak from our realization openly, and Judd Bharat replies by saying, you're a fool for seeing the way you're doing. You have to be ready to take that. But yet, I once went into a university professor's office, and there was a little sign he had on his desk, and it said, ask a question and be a fool for 5 minutes, and don't ask a question and be a fool for your whole life. So, if you're foolish, but it appears that way to me, so here I'm presenting this to you, foolish as it may be. Please reconcile, resolve. What I see is contradictory. I mean, he's very intelligent, but yet, like Arjuna was very intelligent with his doubts in the opening two chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. They were real things, but they were from the practical bodily point of view. And that isn't the ultimate point of view. The ultimate point of view is what Krishna wants. And the spiritual reality from the viewpoint of eternity, things are quite different.
This is a bit intriguing, this idea that from the practical point of view things are different than from the eternal point of view, because it seems like most of our activities go on the practical level and we hear things from Shastra, but our perception of things is not the same. We hear in the second canto about the process of creation, how elements are produced and this and that, vast things that we have no access to, and then we look around and we see our house and our family and our job and our work and our headaches, and you know, it doesn't seem to have any significance, all of that kind of
But then when you look in the mirror, it starts having significance. Because you see grey hair when there was no grey before.
But I don't think about the earth, water, fire.
Well, you don't have to think about that. But the reason, but what you should think of is how great that Lord is who produced those things, and I better take shelter of him quick while I still have grey hair.
That's true.
But at least you have hair. Not like some of us.
But this idea that something is correct...
You've changed the subject. I wonder why.
I don't want to say anything to offend a Vaishnava.
Good answer. Just imagine if I wasn't sitting here giving Bhagavad Gita, what I'd get after that one.
You'd probably offend a Vaishnavi.
Probably get hit with a rolling pin. Go ahead.
It's intriguing, this idea that something, as Prabhupada says, this argument put forward by Maharaj Rahugana is correct from the practical point of view.
Yeah. So there's a few things. See, there's the theoretical point of view, and then there's the practical application of that. If you only act on the practical point of view, your practical dealings will not be in harmony with the philosophical. So therefore you start with the philosophical and understand that, and then you can take the practical and as much as possible harmonize it. So you said house and home, so that's the practical. So there's many, many ways to live in house and home. So what we want to do is to live with house and home in such a way that it is as harmonized as possible with the fact that it's illusion. We still have to live there, but we have to harmonize it as much as possible. Let that home life be harmonized and going in the same direction as our spiritual advancement, as opposed to the exact opposite direction.
Wouldn't there be a tendency to feel sort of repugnance for being in a situation that you know is an illusion and kind of confusion that you would like it?
But
you sort of get messed up?
Not if you have proper guidance. But I think it is possible to get messed up and have your head in the clouds and your feet not on the ground. Yes, I think it's possible. But I don't think it's necessary at all. Because there's also another point put in there, that using the temporary situation in the service of Krishna, so it's not done in a haphazard way, so somehow or another turning it into service, so that becomes part of your devotional service as opposed to an illusion. So therefore Prabhupada started that purport by saying, this is a discussion, Mayavad philosophy. So Mayavads would say it's completely illusion, so therefore your head will be in the clouds and you'll neglect your feet on the ground completely. But when you understand that this is an illusion in the sense it's temporary, let me not mistake this for spiritual reality or reality, but let me, understanding it's temporary, let me use it properly, devotionally, in Krishna service. Then it becomes, the dealings in the material world become on a completely different level. They're not on the level of its illusion, nor on the level of its reality. It's something, it's neither of those. It's
a careful balance between the two.
Well, that takes maturity. But yeah, so
it's pretty challenging when you're not mature.
Well, how can you be mature if you're not mature? But at least boundaries can be made to keep you, and if you're under proper guidance, there'll be boundaries put up so you don't wander one way or the other, that you don't drive off the bridge thinking, oh, it doesn't make any difference anyway, it's illusion. Or you don't get so much into your car taking care of it that, or you're thinking about your car 24 hours a day. So those are the two sides, the two extremes. So, you know, it's sort of, in one sense, it's common sense how to deal with it too. You know, you might not get it exactly right, but at least you can have your boundaries so you don't do either of those two.
I've got two extremes.
Yeah, let's stop. Because it's about that to it. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Jadavarat ki jai. When is it called?